and unsurpassed, penetrating and perfect Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Berkeley Zen Center. Thank you for joining us here in the Zendo, and to everyone who's online. I'm very happy to introduce Jiryu Rushman Beiler this evening, the abbot of Green Gulch Farm, received Dharma transmission from Sojin Mel Weitzman Roshi, our late abbot, and also the elder brother of our own Hondo Dave Rushman. And so Jiryu helped co-edit with Sojin Roshi this new Suzuki Roshi book, Becoming Yourself. And thank you so much, Jiryu, for coming this evening.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you, friends, for coming to my party. For the record, I am senior to Reverend Hondo, but he is my elder brother.
Oh,
my big brother, Dari.
Okay, sorry.
My entanglement with Berkeley Zen Center, wonderful and mysterious and deep, I never practiced here exactly, but I would come around a lot to meet with Mel, and now and then come to a Dharma talk. I think I've never given a talk here before, and it's wonderful to be here. It feels rather formal, and the feeling of formality is good, and also we can be informal together. Like with Mel, you know, it, in my experience at least, it didn't seem to change much, you know, whether it was a formal Dharma talk or Stonehenge. The same person, just a person who had become himself, you know. Suzuki Roshi says, when you just become yourself as thoroughly as the stone is a stone, that's, then you include everything. And then you can practice our way, and the Bodhisattva precepts are right there. So what a wonderful embodiment of that. And our friend Mel. Did most of you know Mel? Some people nowadays don't know Mel. Some of you know, any of you not know Mel? So you know what I mean. He says, you know, when you're not completely yourself, then you don't include everything. But when you are completely yourself, then everything is included. And the Bodhisattva precepts are there. So I just want to say a little bit, you know, we have a few minutes together. We don't need to spend all night here, but we could, because this new book is awesome. And each line, you know, I was remembering this project. I think, I wonder if Paula set it up, a project for the 50th year Zen Mind Beginner's Mind with these Xerox copies of people's annotations. So she got together, just, you know, bring me your Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind copy. And she just flipped through for a nice kind of written up, annotated, highlighted, sort of torn up page. And she zeroed, you know, copied a bunch of them. They were up, and just everybody's finding different lines, you know, and furiously scrambling the thing that they see in that moment. I get it. I got to write it down. And so then put that on the wall, everybody's little notes. But that feeling that each of the lines of Suzuki Roshi's teaching is just actually so simple and clear and bottomless and, you know, always ready to absorb new insight or to offer new insight. So really any of these, that's my experience of coming back again and again to these words and these words in this book, which I've been really part of. This is also kind of like, maybe it's an introduction of the book to some of you, and for me it's like a goodbye finally. You know, get me out of my life, launch it out of my life, leave home, it's time to leave home. And even though I have spent so much time, you know, so with Mel invited me in 2018 to work on this with him. It's really one of the great privileges of my life, actually, to work with Mel side by side on this book. I was so honored to be invited. I think it was mostly because I'm good with spreadsheets, and I can scan documents, and I can, you know, keep a project on track. I think that Mel had started, but kind of was having trouble keeping the project on track. And Ed Sadazan, our San Francisco Zen Center abbot at the time, said, you know, why don't you invite Jiryu? He's good with spreadsheets. So that was my primary qualification. And so we worked, you know. Mel had these folders of these talks that he had returned to over the years. And I think I was hoping to maybe read a few passages. And some of you who've been around probably heard him talk, you know, maybe a few times about some of these favorite teachings from Suzuki Roshi that he loved, but that hadn't yet appeared in the books. So we would sit down together, often over here, and it was so touching to be back in his office and sitting outside this evening as though waiting for Doka-san. It's a good, that's the best moment, waiting for Doka-san, you know? It never lives up to that. So that's part of the gift now of Mel and maybe Suzuki Roshi too, you know, we get to just wait for Doka-san. But so precious to spend that time with him. Just working over these lines, you know, he had some that had been edited before, maybe that Mel had worked on for Windbells or Berkeley Zen Center newsletters. And then there were times when we wanted to kind of go into the transcript archive, this incredible resource of Suzuki Roshi's teaching, you know, that has been preserved and wouldn't have had to have been preserved. It was Marion Derby in 1965 said, you know, we could record this like once in a generation sort of moment that's happening here. We could press record and actually preserve these teachings of Suzuki Roshi. So I feel her presence and insight. And then these so many people, you know, caring for these recordings, making the recordings, transcribing the recordings. So anyway, with Mel, some of these pieces that Mel had already kind of worked on, and then some new pieces that we went into the archive for. And some of it, you know, if you've read the Suzuki Roshi archive, says the editor, you know, when I first said, you know, I have this book of Suzuki Roshi, but, you know, everything Suzuki Roshi ever wrote is just online for free on multiple websites, you know. It's like, what's our market here? But, you know, fortunately for the publisher, it's very hard to read. it's very hard to read that you say, I want to, you know, you go to the transcript archive and you can find real treasures in there, but you have to work for them. You have to mine into that mountain, you know. And so they're not so easy. The Suzuki Roshi's very present, kind of back and forth with the people in the room, and his kind of meandering and the limitation of his English. It's not so easy, really, to polish his work, but Mel had this just obviously deep affinity and understanding of Suzuki Roshi's teachings and was able to sort of bring out the light of what Suzuki Roshi meant to say, and was confident enough and fearless enough to say, no, this is what he meant. So, anyway, really precious to work with Mel on this. And then Mel died. And we really worked on this quite up close to the end. He was still doodling away on this project. And then after he died, you know, I wasn't sure what to do because it seemed like the book still needed some work. I don't know if he thought so, but I thought so. And then Hozan Allen was a really huge support in this process. So just being here and in this place of Sojin and Hozan, and Hozan really helped me to really invited me to take the space and to say, you know, this is on me now. This project is mine now. It's in my hands now, and I can kind of do what I think it needs to get it to where it should go. You know, with Suzuki Roshi forgiving me and Sojin forgiving me. Both of them, you know, it seems to me, had a very clear and simple way. And I have kind of like a convoluted, sort of complicated way. So it was maybe a little too simple before, too pure. So, but with Hozan's support, I was able to add some other pieces and organize things around to bring out what was a really important theme for Sojin. So, and maybe I'll say a little bit about that. But first, maybe just to acknowledge some other supporters. You know, the beautiful cover of this book. It's what an honor it caused to see you here. Thank you for coming. And thank you for offering your work to this cover. You know, the publisher had kind of drafted something, but they didn't really know Suzuki Roshi or our way. And so they had drafted some cool designs, a few cool designs that seemed like, yeah, that could be a cover of a book. And it seemed fine with me. And like, let's move this along, you know? And so I sent it to some people who were involved, and everybody mostly thought it was good enough, but Ozan says, "It's terrible. That's a terrible cover." Which was like inconvenient, you know? Dana Velden at San Francisco Zen Center also had the same, like, it's just not a good cover. It doesn't feel like our way. And it didn't. It was a fine cover, you know? I liked it. Again, I just kind of wanted to get it over with. And then we said, well, what expresses our way? You know, what expresses our way? And of course, its cause is work. And so it seemed like almost impossible that we could be supported to use Kaz's work on the cover, but through his generosity, we're, and I'm really just so happy. This is Enjoy, is that right?
Yes.
Enjoy.
Enjoy.
Enjoy being yourself. The not really being yourself is not so enjoyable. You know? Fundamentally. What a relief. What a relief to just be who you are thoroughly, completely, and naturally appreciate that everything is included in that. And then just live in that way, live from there, together with everyone. So also, I know Lori couldn't be here tonight, but she also, hello.
I'm here.
Hello. You made it.
A bunch of people couldn't be here tonight, but I wasn't.
Thank you for your support in this project. You similarly said, you know, it's not so good. That your editing, you know, really showed me that it wasn't ready, it wasn't cooked. So again, it's like, are you sure? Isn't it good enough? So that kind of support to say, no, it's not. It needs more polishing. The jewel is in there, but it needs more polishing. So thank you. And then Liz, thank you over the years for all of your support and your support of this project. And, as I take this on, it's very humbling and incredible to be in a seat trying to say something about Suzuki Roshi and Sojin. So thank you. And then, so on Tuesday, I'm going to say what the book's about, but it's about the Bodhisattva precepts. But that's kind of a secret because the editor says nobody knows what that means. Could you just not use the word precepts? Because nobody knows what that means. Well, the thing is, it's a book about the Bodhisattva precepts. And then I thought, yeah, I never knew what the word precepts, I don't think I had ever heard that word really before coming into Zen. You know, it's kind of an unusual word. So for those of us who are sort of in the bubble, you know, it's the precepts, we know what we mean. So this kind of the precepts, the ethical direction, the way that we are together with others. So, you know, Mel had these talks that he'd always, you know, come back to. And then he also had the clear idea of bringing out for all of us Suzuki Roshi's teaching on the Bodhisattva precepts, on precepts. He felt that it's very deep and kind of unusual, and the Zen students needed to know how Suzuki Roshi saw the precepts. And he needed me to know as well. So kind of the second half of the book is about the precepts. And the first half is sort of general talks, kind of like Not Always Still or Send My Beginner's Mind. And then the second half is about the precepts. Our friend Peter Coyote, also deeply supportive of the project by narrating the audiobook. So it was a beautiful audiobook. I just got the chance to listen to parts of it on Tuesday when the book launched. And Peter did a really wonderful, wonderful job. At the end of the audiobook, so along with Sojin's kind of confidence and fearlessness in editing was this wish that I had to make sure that people know that this isn't edited. This is not Suzuki Roshi's words exactly. This is edited. And so in the back of the book, there's a section that points people to the relevant to the talk of Suzuki Roshi's that we drew this chapter from, so that if somebody likes the chapter or doesn't like the chapter, then you know, you could go look, what does he actually say? I'm not saying that we got it right. I'm just saying, if this kind of, maybe what's your appetite for Suzuki Roshi's words? And so then we thought for the audiobook that maybe we could do something similar, and for some of the chapters have some clips of the original audio of Suzuki Roshi, and they've been really well done now. you know, by Charlie Wilson and the Engage Wisdom team. They've like triple remastered the Suzuki Roshi. Really, you know, you're used to kind of like barely being able to hear it, but it's very clear and bright. So it's about half an hour at the end of the audiobook that's kind of, here's what Peter Coyote just read the edited version of, and now here's how Suzuki Roshi. And what do you feel in Suzuki Roshi is the joy and the ease and the laughter. So it's wonderful also to listen, and it was just very moving for me to hear Peter and Suzuki Roshi on Tuesday. Thanks for listening. And then on Wednesday, my week. So this is Tuesday, and then on Wednesday, so I live at Green Gulch Farm, Green Dragon Temple over in Marin County, one of the temples associated with San Francisco Zen Center, founded right after Suzuki Roshi died. As some of you know, Tenshin Roshi and Adrian Roshi, Reb and Linda, both kind of early students at San Francisco Zen Center and really, really important and deep teachers in our lineage who lived at Green Gulch for many years. And Linda was actually in the group of the first five people who moved to Green Gulch in, I guess, 1972. And on Wednesday morning, we had a departing ceremony for Reb and Linda and Steve Weintraub and Rusa Chu. So yeah, it's been kind of a week. thank you for your support. This feeling that this kind of, and this was not planned, you know, this is just the magic of our being alive together with everything. So that this lineage, and it's the magic, it's the life of the lineage flowering for millennia, you know. To feel this little flower, you know, humble as it is, that this sort of blossoms, right, as this other, as these elders who've been carrying this tradition so beautifully are stepping away, and that there's a sprout, you know, in this book. It's the first in over 20 years, and to just feel like there's life in the lineage, and the teaching of Suzuki Roshi is like just as resonant and relevant. The teaching of our way really is not about like the 1970s. No, it's really not. Yeah, it's about being a human being. In a true and deep and real way that includes everything. Maybe could I read a little bit from the book? Does anybody want to say anything before I do? I know that Mel really appreciated dogs. I don't know if he disliked cats. He did not dislike cats. He didn't dislike cats.
I just didn't feel the affinity that he had.
Yeah. So one of, you know, I was thinking, what are the ones, you know, that of these chapters that to me were like the most kind of, that Mel was the most, that landed for me as, oh, Mel really liked this one. And he really liked this one about cats. So, and I think it, and then I realized, oh, he really was a dog person. So it's a little bit, it's like not the most flattering about cats, but it's a very deep Dharma point, and I think it really expresses something very true about Suzuki Roshi and very true about Sojin Roshi's understanding as well. I'll just read a little bit of it. There's a couple here that I want to share. So there's a chapter called Respect. Suzuki Roshi says, on Nirvana Day, so that's the day that we're celebrating the death of the Buddha, temples hang scrolls depicting the Buddha lying down, critically ill, surrounded by his disciples and the many animals and birds who had come to see how he was. When they saw him, they all started crying. Buddha's lying there dead. Everyone has come, all the animals, all the beings, to pay their respects and to grieve the loss of their beloved teacher. When people look at that picture, some say, "We cannot find any cats in that picture." I don't know why. No one ever explained to me why the cats didn't come. When I was 16 or 17, I became aware of the superficial expression of good manners. At that time, I didn't like the monk's way, the priest's way. They would always bow, but it didn't seem to me they meant it. They just did it superficially, without any feeling. In a conversation yesterday with Norman and Ruth Ozeki, more support, it's just been amazing, the support from people for this project. Norman brought this point out, you know, how this kind of a ambivalence about religion that Suzuki Roshi had. And it occurred to me that I think that's why he did so well in the United States, you know, because many of us are pretty ambivalent about religion, really have mixed feelings. Like, really love it, but then he's always saying, like, yeah, the monks and the priests, and there's something so true and deep and beautiful. So anyway, so he didn't like, when he was young, he didn't like the superficial way of the priests. Acting in that way, you know, bowing without really meaning it, acting in that way is called cat-like manners. The cat's way looks very gentle and lovely, but it is not so deep. There is no strong feeling in it. If we say, "Go away," they will just go away. If they think it is all right, they may easily approach you. Either way, there is no strong feeling in it. So I thought, that is why the cats did not come to the Buddha's last hour. And then he says, you know, our society, our superficial society, is kind of cat-like in its superficiality. And he appreciates that people with, you know, their long hair and drumming and dancing are rejecting this insincere world, this insincere superficial way of life. And he's saying, I really hear you, that you really, it makes sense that you're rejecting that. And yet, I'm not so concerned about the beatnik style or the hippie style, as long as they can express respect to others in the simplest way. I think they are expressing some resistance to society's cat-like manner. They should also express some respect to the truth or to real religious life, so that we can kind of be antagonistic or be dismissive of the superficial society, but are we actually showing the deep respect to the Buddha, you know, to life itself, to the Zendo? So then he says, you know, so come clean your feet. He's just saying to the people, you know, clean your feet before. It's great that you want to be countercultural. Society is superficial, but are you sincere? Can you show this natural, real respect for something real? That's kind of the theme of this cat-like manners and teaching that respect. I think Mel really liked that one. And then, anybody want to say anything about that? I can share a couple others. Superficial, yeah, you could think that's like, oh, it's not attached. But it's not that it's not attached, it's that it's not feeling sincerely, you know. With all due respect, this is an unfair generalization of cats. I know have a cat, and I'm turning my own view around on that point. Let's see. You know, this is almost, I remember Mel also really appreciating, in a similar vein, this chapter that we called Humor. So I'll just read a couple paragraphs of it. Zen masters have some humorous element in their lives, and after their deaths, we may understand even better how funny they were. They can be humorous because they have an understanding that is more than real. Their humor is more real than reality. Reality is not so real. If you see a comic, that can be more real than the actual event. I think that because Zen masters have something real, they can always be funny. When they say something ordinary, in their mind they are always expressing it as if they are drawing on something comical. For them it is comical, but for us it is a very real and serious thing. And then he tells a story about Kumazawa Zenji, the vice abbot at Eiheiji when Suzuki Roshi was practicing there. And he says that he gave a Dharma talk about a sparrow breaking a stone gate. The sparrow broke a stone gate. And everybody thought, he says, they didn't really understand what he meant, but they thought, this is a Zen story. What he means must be something deep. Recently, I found out that it had been a joke. He was just joking in a serious manner. It was using a pun. And the serious students are completely missing the point. So he says, as he was trained very well in Zazen practice, he was always serious, but he was always funny at the same time. It was not just seriousness, because it always had an element of happiness or joy in it. I don't think many people knew that he was telling a joke, and we didn't talk about that story at all after the talk. When we were young, we did not like such ridiculous stories. We were serious students, you know. We didn't like it at all that he was fooling us, so we didn't talk about it. But quite recently, I thought, he was fooling us when we were practicing so seriously. For maybe 96 years, he was fooling us. When he was dying, he stretched out his arm for the water pitcher, and the attendant gave it to him. He drank from the pitcher and said, "Ka!" And he was no more. He vanished from the world. It was terrible. Newspaper reporters and famous Zen masters admired the way that he had died. But I think he was fooling us. So, what Kumazawa Zenji was doing is something more than we can understand or see. We cannot take the things he did literally. Actually, he wasn't doing anything. He was just moving his mouth, that's all. I don't know how to understand it, but Dogen Zenji has shown us how to be like him. Living with people and living in confusion, but also independent of the confusion. That is the core of our practice. So this sense of if we appreciate what our life actually is, then we can be very sincere and yet not take anything too seriously. One of the points I make in the introduction of the book here is how, you know, Mel thought maybe we could leave in all the places where Suzuki Roshi says, or where the transcript says that people are laughing or Suzuki Roshi is laughing, but they're all over, you know. So then we can't include it. It's, people are laughing through the whole thing, you know. Suzuki Roshi's talking and laughing at himself, and everyone's laughing. And sometimes just he's laughing, which is also just funny, you know. And sometimes everybody's laughing. But there's something about that lightness, you know, that when you feel that, you can understand the teaching much more clearly, when, especially when he's being serious in a way. So it's hard to bring that in when it's words that are printed, you know, to bring in that feeling of lightness or laughter. I think maybe we take a little break now. I don't want to go on too long.
Yeah, do you want to take a break, or do you just want to move into Q&A, or what would you like to do?
Does anybody have anything to say or to share? There's another good story that I could read. And we could continue, or we could wrap up.
We can another story, and then
stretch
or move to like. Usually, we have like a Q&A at the end so that folks online can participate,
okay.
And a little easier
going
so on. It's,
okay.
Yeah. So I think if we want to do that, that's
more
good.
Formal break. Okay.
Yeah.
It's a really good book. No thanks to me. Maybe I won't read this story then, because there's something more important to say. The story is a really good one though. It's about this Zen teacher who was out in the most beautiful landscape and had some time and smoked a cigarette, and it was the most perfect cigarette. It was the most perfect cigarette, so he never smoked again. And Suzuki Roshi says he understood desire, and he understood how to take care of himself. So it's a beautiful story. You know, and this is like Mel and Suzuki Roshi. You know, don't need to explain that too much. But I get into it, and I do all Dharma talk. But it's better to just say you understand already. You know, yeah. It's just, you don't need anything after that. So maybe just briefly, because it really is the heart, you know. There's another story, maybe I'll just summarize, of another teacher of Suzuki Roshi's. You know, so Suzuki Roshi's teaching on the precepts, you know, what it was it that Suzuki Roshi wanted to convey about precepts, and what did Mel think? You all need to understand what he means about precepts. And that is that the precepts are the way that we support each other, the way that we guide our life is something that we have already in us. Our compassion and care and carefulness isn't something that we need to like think about as a set of rules or look for anywhere other than ourselves. We just need to connect with our innately loving heart to just be ourself in a way that includes everything. And then we're acting in accord with the Bodhisattva precepts. He says, if the precepts are a moral code that you have in your mind, then what's going to happen is when you're in a situation, every situation is calling for right action, right? Every situation is calling for the observance of precepts or our ethics, our vow, our longing to live in harmony and wake up with everyone, support people and not cause harm. So when we're in a moment, like now or any other moment, and we want to know what's the right thing to do, that's so important. That's such an important indeed moment. What's the right thing to do? So now we have, if we go to a moral code that we have in our mind, what's happening? We're like removing ourselves from the situation that we're actually in, this embodied presence with a life situation, and we're saying, what is that list? What are those precepts again? What am I supposed to do? What did the book say I was supposed to do? What's number? Does number 8 apply? Does number 3 apply? We're using this mental, this moral code, this idea of precepts, and we're putting that in front of us in a way that's actually taking ourselves from the situation. We're looking outside for some guide. It's not that we just do whatever we want in that situation. It really matters what we do in our life. But the way to be sincere about what we do in our life is to stay connected to Zazen all day long. If we have a gap in our practice when we're checking with the moral code, we're not really following the moral code. You know, the point, the way to practice precepts is to do Zazen. The precepts are what we already have. If you ever wonder how can I be of most benefit, come into the moment with what is here. Open, allow, welcome what's here, and then trust some action to arise from that. It doesn't mean you're going to get it right, you know. You still might make a mess and have to apologize, but that's going to be better than going to a mental, to a moral code. And so these precepts, this way that we're looking for, we already have. So in this other funny story, he says, you know, it's this kid who's running from the temple to get some tofu at the last minute while the bell is ringing for lunch. And he gets all frazzled and then thinks that he doesn't have his hat. That's like us thinking that we're not Buddha, you know, or thinking that we don't know how to actually benefit each other. So he gets all frazzled and he forgets that he has his hat on his head. So he runs back to the shop, you know, like, give me my hat, I left my hat. And the shopkeeper's like, what are you talking about? He says, my hat. He says, oh, the hat's on your head. You know? So that's our practice of precepts is like that. The hat is on your head, and actually you're running around trying to find your way. Yeah. It's not as good as just knowing that you have a hat on your head. Precepts are our nature. So this is really authentic Soto Zen. This is a really traditional, fundamental, deep teaching of our lineage. And we do sometimes study the precepts one by one, you know, we learn the 16. But again and again in here, he's saying, do not study these one by one. Just, and you can, you know, to support. But really the call is to stay in Zazen, to have no gap in our practice. Maybe I'll stop there and if anyone has a comment, or should we?
So to help the folks online hear the questions or comments and conversation, I'll pass around a mic. So just raise your hand if you'd like to say anything, and I'll bring a mic over to you. And if you're online, please feel free to raise your digital hand, and our tech host, Gensan, will call on you. And yeah, so please bring your conversation.
Hi, thank you for coming here to be with us. I haven't made it to Green Gulch to be with you. The last thing you said about just stay in Zazen, right? That's what I wanted to hear more about. Of course, we're not going to stay on our cushion, so we stay with our breath wherever we are. Is that your meaning? About that, to stay in Zazen. I know Sojin used to always talk about knowing where your breath is, so be with your breath. So is that your meaning? I just know after what happened with Baker Roshi, I've been around for a while, everybody was saying, well, we didn't study the precepts. And even when I read something by Rev Anderson, he said, in the book, well, we should have studied the precepts. Mm-hmm. And then Aiken Roshi wrote a whole book, mm-hmm. a big book about the precepts in reaction to that. Mm-hmm. And suddenly it was like, precepts.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway.
Yeah, wonderful. Maybe a two-part question. It turns out that this is like a really deep and ancient question in Buddhism, and that, you know, goes back to like the Tendai tradition, you know, before Dogen, Zenji, and kind of these different ways of understanding precepts as rules to follow or as kind of expression of Buddha nature, you know, and the path of following precepts as a kind of like one precept of Zazen versus the sort of careful, diligent management of your conduct, you know, with the various whatever set of precepts. So this kind of tension between rules that we follow and kind of a mind or a body that we stay devoted to is like too precious a tension to just resolve, you know? So it's like the wings of the bird, you know, or it's like the dynamic energy in the engine that's making it, that's actually creating our practice. So I think it's wonderful that this way of, I think that we're ready, maybe how about that? I think that we're ready to be reminded of the way that there's only one precept, which is Zazen, and that if we actually want to live in a connected and skillful and wise way, that living from our nature and trusting that is deep and valuable and important. And then we study the precepts to help to refine that. You know, Suzuki Roshi says we study the precepts in order to better understand the one reality that all the precepts are pointing to. So it's not a carelessness. It's a kind of way of expressing the sincerity. But so I think it's wonderful. Now there are various books now about Bodhisattva precepts that go one by one. And I think we're ready for a book that doesn't go one by one, that says, why are you going one by one? That says, we don't go one by one. That says, you should not go one by one. And now that we've gone one by one, you know, maybe we weren't ready before we went one by one. So it's both. And so what is that? What is that care? What is that Zazen? You know, this expression of Shikantaza as being yourself, just to sit as yourself. So that's not so clear, you know, that's not like an instruction, like breath counting is an instruction, but it is a Dharma gate. And in this collection, at least, we kind of bring out Suzuki Roshi saying that again and again. What does he mean, Zazen? He means being totally yourself, which isn't the self that you know, isn't the self that you've figured out. In fact, don't try to figure out who you are. It's another chapter that Mel really liked. Don't try to figure out who you are. That's not what I'm talking about. So to just be what this is completely, it includes everything. So that's not like hold on to an experience that you have of what it feels like to sit and then carry that through your life somehow. It means every moment you are just you yourself. That we feel like, but I can't trust that. And the invitation is, maybe you can. Maybe you can. And if you don't, you know, maybe you can connect a little more fully, a little more deeply with what is this me being me right now. So, but wonderful. To me, the emphasizing precepts and then emphasizing the precepts are Zazen is different than dismissing precepts by saying precepts are Zazen. We don't need to worry about precepts because they're just Zazen. It's more like precepts are the most important thing and they're Zazen. It's a different feeling. And that's what I feel like is coming through in this book. But we have not, keep reading the other books too. And keep asking your friends for how you're doing, you know. It's not like, well, I was coming from Zazen, you can't blame me that I said something mean. I was just being one with everything in my true self. So Suzuki Roshi, in a piece that we didn't include in here, it appears in Branching Streams, Flowing in the Darkness, he says, you know, do not kill is the dead precept. Excuse me is the living precept. I'm sorry is the living precept. It's not like, oh, I'm in Zazen, so nobody can blame me for how I'm for what I'm doing. It includes that we are sorry. In here he says, you know, how do we not kill? We say not to kill, and now we're eating this food. He says, I used to think that was so hypocritical. These people would go to the temple and they would say, I vow not to kill. And then they'd go home and eat rice, which involves the killing of all these bugs. And so again, this is his kind of like anger at Buddhism. It's so funny, it really comes out. And then he says, so I thought they were hypocritical, but now I see when they said, I vow not to kill, that was an expression of something very true and deep. Right there. So just keep saying, I vow not to kill. And then it's not like you succeed at that. So then you say, I'm sorry. So he says, you're eating the rice and you have the idea, maybe I'm making a mistake. I'm not so sure. If you're like studying the precepts in a real black and white way and you know the precepts, then you can say, I got this all checked out, you know, by the lawyer and the Buddha. And what I eating this rice is permissible. So, and I'm sure of it, you know, and I'm following the precept. Suki Roshi's way is more like, I'm not so sure that I'm not breaking the precept now by eating this rice. I may be making some mistake. I'm sorry. And my heart is filled with gratitude. And that's how I'm observing the precept. But yes, it's a very open way. And I appreciate your question. I told you I was complicated.
We do have a question online.
We'll take one more in the Zendo and then we'll go online.
Okay.
There's a notion going around that's kind of derogatory that labels things as spiritual bypass.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I wonder how that may figure into your work on the book.
Spiritual bypass. Spiritual bypass, what a wonderful, rich Dharma time we live in, you know. All of the doubt just clarifies the true teaching. So you might say, well, that Zen looks like spiritual bypass. And then the faith part says, so that means the real Zen is the Zen that doesn't have spiritual bypass. The doubt clarifies the faith, you know. So the spiritual bypass is like, I'm not including something. So again and again, this is one of the things that really was affirmed to me. Maybe some of you maybe also knew Sado Lee DeBarros. Anybody know Lee? Lee was my ordination teacher. And he would always teach in this way. Include everything, welcome everything. It's not just him, but it really landed, you know, because I was so open when he would say those words. Again and again in Suzuki Roshi's teaching, our way is to include everything. We're not trying to get some particular experience or some particular feeling, so then there's no need to exclude anything. Why would we push something away? It's because we want to have some kind of experience, right? Or we want to protect something. Does that make sense? If we're just willing to be ourselves exactly as we are, including everything, then we're not bypassing anything because we're not trying to get something. We don't have some idea in our mind about what spirituality is and then something else that's like in the way of that, so we want to kind of cover that over. So for me, this practice, there is a kind of psychological, you know, there's myriad ways to see this teaching on including everything. When a stone is really a stone, when a stone is just a stone through and through, it includes everything. When we practice in a way that includes everything, there's nothing left in the shadow, you know, there's nothing that needs to be pushed away. So I think that vow, that aspiration to just include everything, to welcome everything, is kind of like the opposite of spiritual bypass. But I wonder if that resonates for you, or if you have that concern that some aspect of practice is like avoiding some of the relatives.
I think the forms can have you, I think the complexity of the forms can delude you. mm-hmm. into thinking you have that spiritual direction.
Mm-hmm. As Sojin used to say a lot, you know, how to use them without being used by them. Suzuki Roshi again and again is talking about, you know, if we want to be free from the forms by not doing the forms, it's better to be in a limitation. It's better to find ourselves, I don't know better, but Suzuki Roshi's way was to be in some limitation and to find ourselves through the limitation. One of my favorite pieces, he says, you know, we want to be free of limitation and have the whole universe, but really it'd be better to just have a small stone. You think you can get the whole universe, but just take a small stone. That's how you get the whole universe. So the kind of embrace of limitation, it's not a preciousness of like the form has to be this way or that way. It's just, can we pour ourselves wholeheartedly into some limitation and then just see that that small thing, that small room, that small stone actually includes everything without getting any bigger than it is. So, but yes, it's kind of a dangerous practice, the formal practice. And I feel some Suzuki Roshi's ambivalence too, you know, sometimes he's like, oof, or again, we need to make a Zen center to help people, but it's going to be very confusing for people to have a Zen center. We just want people to be themselves, you know. So anyway, but thank you. Yeah, we need to take good care of our whole being. And I do feel like the Dharma in the United States is at a good place now with that kind of psychological awareness and respect for the wisdom of those traditions. And the ability to be completely free of everything we think about what is happening here is also really important for our real freedom. Maybe one or two more comments and then we should close. I feel I'm keeping you a long time.
All right, Gen-san, you want to call on someone online?
Good evening. Joyu, this is Mary. Thank you for the offering today and tonight. And also thank you for the long, I guess it's 8-year journey of shepherding this project, which I am quite certain wouldn't have materialized without that effort on your part. I came to Berkeley Zen Center because I wanted to be close to someone who had been close to Suzuki. And what I found in Sojin was someone who carried, I don't know how to say it, but maybe the whiff of Suzuki, you know, the odor of the robe or something. In his being, in his way of being. And I ended up over time feeling like I learned more about what it means to be in relationship, the relationship, feeling the devotion of Sojin with Suzuki and feeling the aliveness of Suzuki through Sojin was maybe the most moving teaching. And so my question is, what was it like for you to be a witness to that, to the relationship between those two? And what was the texture of it for you?
So describe that smell. Part of what's wonderful, you know, I arrived at kind of in the Zen Center world and 1996. So of course, never knew, you know, Suzuki Roshi. And, but knew a lot of people who knew Suzuki Roshi and who felt that they really understood Suzuki Roshi, you know, or had something special with Suzuki Roshi. I remember Peter Schneider. I made some comment, I don't know, I think I made some comment like, you know, Mel really understood Suzuki Roshi. And Peter said, Ozawa Mel, Ozawa Mel says. I guess so, yeah. To see these people who are so different, you know, so different. These teachers who have that, so what is that smell, you know, and that's part of the, yeah. But I do, I guess I really did believe Mel, that he had a kind of like, when I say that he knew what he meant, it just felt like he just knew what he meant. He really, but I hear you about that quality of relationship. And it brings to mind, I can't describe it, I'm sorry, just that, you know, all of us, so Mel, you know, I asked him, you know, how do you prepare a Dharma talk? And he said, well, you know, you come a little while before the Dharma talk, maybe an hour, half an hour before the Dharma talk. And then it seemed like you just look in Suzuki Roshi for what chapter you want to talk about. And then you just come to, and you just share the chapter. Yeah. In Sojin's last talk at Green Gulch, he told this story and it was so touching. It moved him to tears actually. And that was, it was a really beautiful moment where he was sharing this very simple story of, I don't remember the case, you know, or the names of the people, but the student who kept not getting teaching from the teacher. And he says, like, you know, I've been at this temple for all these years and you haven't given me any teaching. And so this kind of goes on like that for a while. And then in the end, the teacher says, all I've been doing is giving you teaching. When you bring me the tea, I receive it and drink, you know, this intimacy of this embodied silent, just, we're just living together, serving and receiving tea. What were you waiting for? What are you talking about? When am I gonna give you the teaching? So just that sense that it's really just about this embodied presence. And I always felt that with Mel, that I wasn't coming to see Mel to learn something in my mind at all, but more like to just align like honing a knife or something, just kind of like align the vibration of our practice together. Is that too hippie to put it that way? I'm sorry, it's a beautiful question, and I not done it justice. Thank you for appreciating that special flavor between Sojin and Suzuki Roshi. And I know he wanted to share that, and many of us also felt that with Sojin, as you did.
Yeah. Thank you.
Shall we close? Thank you so much for your kind attention.